We've made it to the middle chapter of the three in this final unit. And this one has to do with inheritance. First, we'll talk about Mendelian inheritance. And then we'll go on to non-Mendelian inheritance. But Mendelian inheritance gets its name in honor of Gregor Mendel, who hopefully is famous nowadays. Have you heard of Mendel? Okay. You know which one he is, by the way? So he's not famous enough to spot. He was a monk, so this is his monk shot. And he's this one right here. I think he's holding a pea flower, which he's famous for working with, which we'll talk about. But anyway, he's thankfully nowadays he's known as the father of modern genetics, but he didn't get really any credit for the work he did until well after he died. He worked on the stuff that we're going to talk about in the middle of the 1800s, and he was unusual as a biologist for that day. These were the times when biology was mostly an observational or descriptive science rather than an experimental one. So most biologists were naturalists, people who would go out into nature and catalog all the animals, plants, fungi, and other things they could find in that particular area. Wasn't as nearly as much experimentation going on in biology. And accordingly, in these days, biologists didn't really have a good handle on statistics and the importance of statistics. But Mendel did. Mendel realized that to do successful experimentation, you have to have large sample sizes. Otherwise, you just can't interpret meanings. And there's no way he would have been able to figure out what he did if he had used just one or two subjects. He did things over and over, hundreds or thousands of times using these pea plants. And even though this was in the days when we had no idea what a chromosome was, let alone DNA, he figured out how this stuff works, which is pretty impressive. But although he published a now famous paper, no one noticed until after he died. And then someone finally did notice and said, there might be something important here. Let's look at the technique he used. Slide two. He worked with more than just pea plants, but mostly he was using pea plants, which is what we're looking at here. And this isn't true of all flowering plants, but it is for peas. They are examples. Well, in flowering plants in general, the flower is the reproductive organ. And in peas and a bunch of other species, a flower has both male and female parts. Depends on the species whether that's true, but it's true for peas. And the male parts of a flower are called stamens. They're the little filaments here, and they end in a little bulbous terminus called the anther, which is where pollen grains are formed. Well, each pollen grain contains a sperm. So the male carpels, I mean the male stamens are the gonads, the male gonads of the species. They produce the male gametes. Whereas the carpel, which is this bowling pin shaped thing, is the female gonad. Or it actually houses the gonad, which in the bulbous part of the bowling pin shape in the carpel, that's where the ovary is, where the eggs are produced. So those are the female gametes. And whether they're both in the same flower or not, there will be some flowers with pollen grains being formed that contain sperm, and some that have carpels. And the sticky end of the carpel is called the stigma. That's where the pollen grains stick. And if that happens, that's not fertilization. But that makes fertilization easier because when a pollen grain does stick to the end of the carpel, it actually burrows a tunnel through the whole length of this so that the sperm cell that the pollen grain is carrying can be released onto one of the egg cells produced in the ovary in there. And if they meet up, then you can have fertilization. And that usually happens pretty much randomly, whether it's by insects, you know, a bee will come by and brush some pollen grains on its body and it'll go to another flower and it's not trying to do it, it just delivers it. Or the wind blows, whatever. But this is an experiment, so he had to control this. So Mendel had to very carefully remove the stamens, the male parts, from flowers that he was going to use as the mothers, basically, the females. And he had to do it in a way that he didn't release any of the pollen grains, so it was a careful technique. And then he went to another batch of plants in a different field that he was maintaining and carefully brushed off the pollen grains from those that he was using as the fathers, the males, and then went back to the other ones that he cut the male parts off of and brushed the pollen grain onto those carpels. In other words, he was in charge of what the parents were, which parent was crossed with which other parent. And it's tedious work, and it's also, you don't have any idea whether you're doing it right until quite a bit later, because all you can do then, if you do all of this, is wait to see whether anything happens. And what can happen, or what will happen if it's successful, is that reproduction occurs. Fertilization is what causes the fruit to emerge. Flowers, if they are fertilized, turn into fruit. And the fruit of a pea plant is a pod of peas. You know, that'll tell you you've at least got fertilization, but it still doesn't tell you whether the technique is right. But anyway, each pea in a pod is a different individual. It's like brothers and sisters. They're genetically different from each other, just like brothers and sisters are. Each one can grow up into an adult individually. But even once you have this, then you have to plant those, and then you have to wait till the next season when they become adult plants before you can get your results for just one experiment. And so it took him years to do all of this, carefully keeping separate fields of pea plants and doing the same technique over and over. But what we have listed here is what's called the parental generation, or just the pea generation for short. That's the one where he chose the parents. The offspring of that are then called the first filial generation. Filial just means having to do with offspring, or the F1 for short. And as we'll see, he then would cross an F1 with another F1, and their offspring would be the F2 generation. Okay, now three, we're looking at just one of his seven major experiments that he did with pea plants. They all used exactly the same technique I just described, but he had to keep those all separate too, so he had a lot of different fields he had to be working with. What makes them different is that he paid attention to something different in each one. He did exactly the same thing, but there's only certain things that he cared about observing in each set. And so this brings up an important point I need to make. I need to make the distinction between the terms characteristic and trait. And that's important because in everyday language, we pretty much use these two words interchangeably, right? But they're not the same in genetics. They have distinct meanings. And it's a lot better, rather than trying to actually give you formal definitions of the two, it's best just to give you examples, and I think you'll understand. So a characteristic can be just about anything that's observable or measurable about a given organism. It doesn't have to be something that you can see, which this example is, but humans are so visually oriented, such visually oriented animals, that that's a good thing to do. So, for instance, like eye color is an example of a characteristic, right? But we know from experience that there's not just one eye color in humans. There's multiple ones, right? Well, each individual color, like blue or hazel or whatever, is a trait of that characteristic. So traits are specific values of a given characteristic. And that's what he paid attention to differently in each of his seven experiments. They all were conducted exactly the same way with respect to the scissors and the brush. But in each different experiment, he paid attention to one characteristic and ignored all other characteristics. We're looking at one of those seven experiments, and in this experiment, he cared only about flower color. So he didn't care how tall the plants grew or anything else. But is it clear that flower color is the characteristic, and there are two traits here, right? Purple and white are traits of the same characteristic, flower color. He couldn't just jump into this experiment either, because he had to make sure that he was using true breeding parents. And that takes some work just to do that by itself. A true breeding purple-flowered individual is called that because they will only ever produce purple-flowered offspring if you cross a true breeder with another true breeder. Well, you don't really know that, especially when he had no idea what genes are. He couldn't test any DNA. You don't really know that unless you actually go through with some crosses and wait till the next season and look at all the offspring. So he had to do that before he could even start the experiments. But each of these is a true breeder. True breeding purple-flowered, true breeding white-flowered parent, and they make up the P generation. When he crossed those and then planted the peas, let those grow up into the F1 generation, and so he could look at their flowers, he noticed that not only were there no white-flowered individuals in the F1, they were all purple, but they also were all fully purple. They were all just as purple as the purple parent. And if you pause here and think about it, this is kind of counterintuitive. Because for thousands of years before Mendel was born, we had already known just from experience that in sexual species, the offspring seemed to be a mixture of the two parents' traits, right? The offspring are not exactly like the father or the mother. They are partially, it's a mixture. And therefore, just based on that experience, you would probably predict that the F1s would be not purple or white, but purplish white. And they weren't. That's what I mean by fully purple. They were just as purple as the true breeding adult. I mean, true breeding purple parent. So that's a fascinating observation as it is. And also, by the way, you wouldn't really know that there are no whites if you only did this once. You would just think, well, I happened to get a purple one. But when he did it hundreds of times, 1,000 times basically, in this one, because these are real numbers down here, and got no whites, then that tells you pretty damn well that it's whites are not possible in the F1. And he could have just stopped there and tried to figure out what was going on, or just presented as an interesting observation. But then he had the insight to go on and produce the F2 generation by crossing one of these F1s with another F1. So a brother and a sister, basically. crossed to produce the F2. And here's where he got an even more interesting result. So he had roughly 1,000 F2 individuals, and he noticed that almost exactly 3/4 of them were purple, and this fully purple, and almost exactly 1/4 of them were white. So white disappeared in the F1 generation and then reappeared in the F2. And purple is there in each generation, but clearly seems to dominate over white, which is what gives rise to the two terms describing the traits, dominant and recessive. So in this case, purple is the trait that dominates over the recessive. Recessive gets its name because it's the adjective of recede, which means to hide, to draw back and hide, which is what it seems to be doing for the F1 generation, that it comes back out. This brings up an important point. I mentioned at the beginning that we're starting with Mendelian genetics. This is an example of a characteristic that behaves in a Mendelian fashion. It is inherited in a Mendelian fashion. There's a specific set of requirements for that to be true. Not everything operates like this. And Mendel probably at least partially got lucky, because if he had done something that doesn't work in a Mendelian fashion, it would have been much more confusing to him, even with his high numbers. But here are the requirements for a characteristic to be inherited in a Mendelian fashion. One is that there has to be exactly two possible traits for the characteristic being studied. Now, there's all kinds of characteristics, but you're ignoring everything but one. So in the population is what I mean. In the population, there have to be only two possible traits for that characteristic. And there were here, purple and white, no other possibilities. That's one requirement. The other is that one of those two traits has to completely dominate over the other, which it does here. So you have to have exactly two traits for the characteristic, and you have to have what's called complete dominance. Okay. In 4, we see just a table of the results for his other, this is all 7 of his major pea plant experiments. Like I said, they were all conducted the same way, but with different fields of plants. And in each experiment, he cared about only one characteristic, which was different in all the experiments. So we just looked at the flower color one. He did flower position, seed color, and so on. When he did all of this, they all, this is probably partially lucky, they all happened to be Mendelian characteristics. So there were only two possible traits for each one. Two seed colors, two seed shapes, blah, blah, blah. And therefore, when he did it all the same way, and he looked at, well, when he looked at the F1, in every case, all of the F1s had just one of the traits. That's what defines the dominant trait. They were all exactly like the dominant parent. And then when he looked at the F2s, not only did he get that recessive trait again, but he always got the same ratio, 3-1, almost exactly, which he wouldn't have done if he didn't have high sample sizes, right? If you do a trillion, you're going to get almost exactly 3. The higher the sample size, the closer you get to what the expected ratio is. But in all of these different cases, totally different characteristics, they all gave a 3-1 ratio. And so this is really what got him thinking about how this is working, and he came up with the idea that since it's a ratio of integers, whole numbers, it's acting like there are particles that are being transmitted from parent to offspring, discrete particles. And we nowadays we know that the particles of inheritance are genes. He had no idea what a gene was, though. Okay, so these are all Mendelian examples, but we just looked at one of them, the flower color. Let's explain this now the way Mendel couldn't with our knowledge of DNA. So in slide 5, we're looking at one type of chromosome. I don't know what the N is for pea plants, but it's more than one. This is just one type of chromosome, and we're ignoring all the others because this is the only one of however many types of chromosomes pea plants have. This is the only one that carries the gene for flower color. That's why we're ignoring all the others. All right? But this brings up some more definitions. A gene, remember, is just a subset of the overall length of the DNA in a chromosome. The overall length is one tremendously long nucleotide sequence. A gene is just a shorter sequence within that longer sequence. But it's a real thing. You know, the sequence is real. It's actually made up of material. That sequence exists. And therefore, any subsequence, any gene that's in that chromosome is at a particular position. And we call the position of any particular gene its locus, which is really just another name for location, same root. Okay, so the gene locus here is this position on this type of chromosome. That's where you find flower color gene. There's thousands of other genes even on this only chromosome that we're looking at. But we're not only ignoring the other chromosomes, we're also ignoring all the other genes on this one chromosome. All we care about is this flower color gene. This is one kind of chromosome, but why are there two here? They came from each parent, but they're now both part of one individual plant. Why are there two, though? Because it's diploid. Plants live their adulthood, well, the sporophyte generation does at least, as diploid individuals, just like we do. So their cells, which make up their bodies, have two of each type of chromosome. And they are homologous because they're the same kind of chromosome. What that means is that in a diploid, which this is, if you're paying attention to one gene, which we are, then that diploid individual will have two of those genes. There's going to be a locus at the same position on each of these two because they're homologous. But remember that homologous chromosomes are not necessarily identical. Well, they're not identical, but certain little sequences can be identical, but not the entire thing. So what this means is that although we say it's the flower color gene, or the whatever gene for any given particular gene, there can actually in a population be multiple versions of that one gene, like the flower color gene, because the sequences are different in the different versions. They occupy the same locus, they control the same characteristic, but they're different in terms of their nucleotide sequence. So this is another definition. We call different versions of the same gene alleles. Now, I want you to make sense of a correspondence between things we've talked about. Traits are individual values of a characteristic, as I've said. Well, characteristics, a characteristic corresponds to a gene, molecularly speaking. A gene corresponds to a characteristic. A gene controls a characteristic. Each allele of that gene corresponds to a trait of that characteristic. And that's why here we have labeled a purple allele and a white allele. They're both versions of the same gene, flower color gene, but they're different alleles. And to extend that correspondence to what I was talking about earlier for the requirements for it to be Mendelian inheritance, you can say that for it to be Mendelian, it has to be two traits exactly for the one characteristic. You could also say there has to be exactly two alleles in the population for the gene that you're studying. It's the same thing, just the molecular version. And further, one of those two alleles has to be completely dominant over the other. Okay, then, let's go on to six. And look at the same exact cross we did earlier, the flower color one, with some new information added. Specifically, well, this brings up a couple more definitions, which are phenotype and genotype. Now, phenotype is more or less the same as trait. The phenotype of an organism, keeping in mind that all you care about is one characteristic, the phenotype is the observable trait for that characteristic that you're studying. And by observable, I don't necessarily mean that you have to look at it or can look at it to do it. For instance, one characteristic could be how well an enzyme works, or whether an individual can taste a certain chemical. Those are not things you look at to see the trait, but their traits are measurable. That's what I mean by observe. Anyway, phenotype and trait pretty much interchangeable, and we use words or phrases to denote phenotypes, like purple-flowered is a phenotype, white-flowered is a phenotype. The genotype, on the other hand, as the name implies, is concerned with the actual molecule, the gene itself, which is either one allele or another. So a genotype is a symbolic representation of the actual allele or alleles in a particular cell. And I say allele or alleles because a cell can be haploid or diploid, depending on the cell type. Right? Well, genetic makeup here really refers to genotype. And notice that they are strings of the letter P. Each parent has a genotype that's made up of only the letter P. This is one standard that genetics uses to denote genotypes. P stands for purple because it's dominant, but notice that we use P also to denote white. We always use P even if it's white because that reminds us of which one is dominant. But we have to have a way to distinguish between dominant and recessive on the P, so we use case. Uppercase P is purple, the purple allele. Lowercase p is the white allele. And these parents that make up the P generation are diploid individuals. So they have to have a diploid genotype, since a diploid is going to have two alleles for flower color, right? They have two chromosomes. So they have a diploid genotype. And uppercase P is a symbolic way of representing that this is a true breeding individual. Now, this brings up a few more definitions. In a diploid, that diploid, by definition, is carrying two alleles, right, for whatever characteristic, for whatever gene. But that means there are three possibilities. If there are two alleles in the population, which we're assuming, then there are three possibilities for any given individual. Two broad possibilities, though, of those three are that the individual has one of each of the two possible alleles, which is what the case was pictured in the previous slide, slide 5. This is an individual that has one purple allele and one white allele. So that's one possibility, one of each of the two alleles. And we call that individual heterozygous. Well, that's the adjective, or you could call the individual a heterozygote. Hetero means different. And so heterozygous linguistically means capable of making different zygotes, because when you make gametes, which are required to make zygotes, you do that via meiosis in a diploid, and that chooses one of the two alleles you have. Well, if you have two different ones, then you can make two different kinds of gametes. That's why the heterozygous word was invented. The other broad possibility is that the diploid individual has two of the same allele, which we call a homozygous individual. Homo means same. But notice that in a population where there are two possible alleles, there's two ways for an individual to be homozygous. The individual can have two of the dominant alleles, two purples, or have two whites, two recessives. So even though we use heterozygous by itself, because that totally describes the situation, the word stands by itself, we don't use the word homozygous by itself because you don't know which of the two possibilities it is. We therefore say either homozygous dominant or homozygous recessive. You don't say heterozygous dominant. So another word, another phrase for true breeding is homozygous. Another phrase for true breeding purple, in this case, is homozygous dominant. And the corresponding genotype for homozygous dominant is uppercase P, uppercase P. Correspondingly, lowercase p is a genotype for a homozygous recessive individual, true breeding individual with a recessive trait. Okay, well, these are just the parents. They're diploids. If they're going to be crossed, they have to first make gametes. And they're diploids, so gametes in diploids are produced via meiosis, as we studied. And when all we're paying attention to is this one gene, that means meiosis is going to randomly choose one allele or the other. Really, what it chooses is one entire chromosome or the other, right? But the chromosome is carrying the gene. Well, this is why there's really only one possibility. It doesn't matter which of these uppercase P's gets chosen for the gamete. The gamete is going to have an uppercase P from this parent, and it's going to have a lowercase p from the other parent. So, but look at the gametes. The gametes have haploid genotypes. You can tell they're haploid genotypes because there's only one letter in each of them. And that's appropriate for gametes, right? Gametes need to be haploid so that when they combine in fertilization to produce a zygote, that zygote is going to be only diploid, not higher level. It avoids the buildup of genetic information. Okay, so what this means is that since each parent can make only one kind of gamete with respect to flower color, when you cross these two, there can be only one possible genotype for the offspring, uppercase P, lowercase P. And this explains molecularly what Mendel saw in the F1. They all had the same exact trait because there's only one possible genotype, upper lower. And what word would we use for an uppercase lowercase genotype? Right. All of the F1s, in other words, are heterozygotes. And the reason that they were all purple in particular is because purple is the dominant allele. A practical way of looking at dominance, complete dominance, by the way, is that incomplete, if you have complete dominance, It takes only one dominant allele to give you the dominant trait, to fully give you the dominant trait. So all of these F1s have one dominant allele, which is half as many as the parent has, right? It has two dominant alleles. But in this case, one dominant allele is enough to make you fully purple. The second one doesn't make this parent any more purple. Yeah?
So for heterozygous, they have two different kinds of hormones combining
No, the heterozygous individual is a diploid. It was produced by the fusion of two gametes to make the zygote it started out as. Just like you became a diploid zygote when your mother's and father's gametes fused to make your zygote.
And a homozygote's a
haploid? No, don't be confused by the word zygous or zygote in these words. Heterozygous can define a diploid individual. It does define it. But it's called that because that diploid individual can produce two different kinds of gametes, and therefore can lead to two different kinds of zygotes. You sure you understand that? Okay, so that explains Mendel's observations. They're all heterozygous, and because it's complete dominance, they're all fully purple. But now let's cross one of these F1s with another F1. Well, they're both heterozygous. They all are. So we can abbreviate a cross, by the way, by just using the genotypes. So upper, lower, and then an X for the cross with another upper, lower. Well, these are diploid individuals, and if they're going to be crossed, they have to make their own gametes, right? But since they're heterozygous, when meiosis randomly chooses one or the other chromosome, it means there's two possible kinds of gametes it can make with respect to flower color, either the uppercase P1 or the lowercase P1. Same for this individual. So that's why an Englishman eventually made this shorthand notation that we're seeing on the bottom, which is called a Punnett square. A Punnett square is really just a shorthand notation to represent a real biological process. What is the actual biological process that's being represented by a Punnett square? What process am I talking about? Well, you have eggs listed here, you have sperm listed here, so what must I be talking about? Right. A Punnett square is just a box that represents the process of fertilization. But it's an exhaustive listing of all the possible gametes that each of the two parents can make when all you care about is the one characteristic. Of course, as I've taught before, mathematically, there's a limitless number of total gametes that each parent can make, but that's when you consider all possible characteristics. Here we're focusing on just this one characteristic, and there's only two possibilities for each. So you list all the sperm on one side of the box, or the square, I mean, and all the eggs on another side of the square, and you simply match up egg and sperm, which is what happens in fertilization. That's why this is representing fertilization. Remember that it's random fertilization, where one of the gametes that is possible from one parent gets randomly picked, and also from the other. That's why you have to account for all possibilities here. Well, if there's two possible eggs and two possible sperm, then the total number of possibilities is four. That's why in this Punnett square, but not all, there happen to be four boxes in it. But what is represented by each box? What does each box represent? What real biological thing? Well, remember what we've already said. The overall Punnett square represents fertilization, a real process. What real objects are represented by the boxes in there? Right. Each box is a zygote that's possible to be created by these particular two parents. Now, don't misunderstand the fact that there's four here. This does not at all mean that these parents are going to have four offspring. It just means that however many offspring they have, each offspring is one of these four possibilities, because they can. Those are the four possible kinds of zygotes they can make when all you care about is flower color. So they could have one offspring, they could have a trillion. If they do have a trillion offspring, what the Punnett square predicts, because Punnett squares are predictions really, is that 750 billion of those offspring, 3/4 of the trillion, should have purple flowers, and 250 billion, 1/4 of the trillion, should have white. All right? And notice that's where the 3-to-1 ratio comes from that Mendel noticed in all of his experiments. So that's a famous Mendelian ratio, 3-to-1, that occurs in the F2 generation. If you have the kind of cross we're looking at, which is yet another definition. The cross we've been studying here, and in fact all seven of those, but this flower color one that we're looking at, is an example of a monohybrid cross. Now the hybrid part of that word refers to mixture, right? What makes this a hybrid cross, first of all, is that the two parents in P generation have different traits for the characteristic we're studying. One of them is purple, one of them is white. That alone makes it a hybrid. What makes it specifically a monohybrid cross, the mono meaning one, refers to the fact that all we care about is one characteristic. We're ignoring everything else. And so if you have a Mendelian characteristic or a Mendelian gene, one that behaves in a Mendelian fashion, and you perform a monohybrid cross all the way through to F2, then the F2 will feature a 3-to-1 ratio of dominant phenotype to recessive phenotype. That's just one of two kinds of ratios, though, as we see in 7. So on the left, we have this phenotypic ratio that I was just describing. 3 dominant phenotypes or traits to 1 recessive in however many offspring there are. 100 offspring, you'd expect 75 purples, 25 whites, and so on. But we also have what's called a genotypic ratio, a ratio of possible genotypes. And this is a different ratio because there are 2 different ways for an individual to be dominant. So I've already told you certain things about complete dominance, right? Which is, it takes only one dominant allele to give that individual the full dominant trait. Conversely, that means that the only way an individual can have the recessive trait is to have 0 dominant traits or alleles, which means to have both alleles be the recessive one. In other words, an individual with the recessive trait has to be homozygous recessive. But that leaves 2 other possible individuals, homozygous dominant and heterozygous. They're both going to look the same or have the same observable trait, like purple flowers. Okay? And so since there's 2 different ways to have the dominant trait, there's 3 numbers in the genotype. It's a 1-to-2-to-1 ratio in the F2 for genotypes. One of the homozygous dominant individual to two heterozygous individuals to one homozygous recessive individual. And you can see that comes directly from the Punnett square we just looked at in the previous slide. There's only one of the four is homozygous dominant, only one of them is homozygous recessive, but there's two possible ways of the four to become heterozygous. You can get the dominant from your mother and the recessive from your father, or the dominant from your father and the recessive from your mother. Okay, that's why there's two of these diagonals, and that's why it's a 1:1 to 2:1 genotypic ratio. But you'll always see that ratio as well if you have a Mendelian gene and a monohybrid cross that goes all the way to F2. All right, now to 8. This is another cross, but it's a special kind of cross called a test cross. And there are different kinds of test crosses, but this test cross is used to determine the genotype of an individual with a dominant phenotype. We were just talking about the fact that if an individual has the dominant trait, there's two possibilities as far as genotype for that, right? An individual could be homozygous dominant or heterozygous. And you're not going to be able to tell, in the case of a visual one like flower color, just by looking at the individual, what the genotype is. Notice, by the way, that you can tell just by looking at the white-flowered individual what its genotype is. You don't have to get in there and molecularly look at the DNA because of the fact that there's only one way to become, to have the recessive trait, which is to have both of your alleles be recessive, in other words, to be homozygous recessive. You know just by looking at an individual with the recessive trait what that genotype is. And we take advantage of that by crossing a dominant individual, which you're trying to figure out the genotype of. All you know is that it's dominant because it has the dominant trait. You're trying to figure out what the genotype is, and you cross it with a recessive individual. Now, there's all kinds of different reasons why you might want to know the genotype. It's valuable information. For instance, if you're trying to sell these things and no one wants to buy the white ones, you want to make sure you have true breeding ones, right? So it's not enough to just know that this is a purple flower. You want to know that it's homozygous, for instance. But for whatever reason, this test cross will do it. Notice there are two Punnett squares here, though. And that's because there's two possibilities. The two possibilities, which are what you're testing for, which one is true, in other words, are that the dominant individual is heterozygous or the dominant individual is homozygous dominant. So these are the two possible genotypes. There can't be any other possibility or it wouldn't be purple, right? This individual is either upper P or upper lower P. And the test cross is used to determine which of those is true. But, as I said before, Punnett squares are predictions. And there's one Punnett square for each of the two possible genotypes if you cross it with the lower P. Right? So this is the Punnett square corresponding to upper P. This one could make only one kind of gamete. You cross it with the other one that's only going to be white. This one is the Punnett square corresponding to the possibility of this one being an upper P, lower P, heterozygous individual. We'll look at the predictions. If this one you're trying to figure out is actually homozygous, then it's going to be impossible, no matter how many offspring are produced, to make a white-flowered individual offspring. Whereas if it's a heterozygous individual, you expect however many offspring there are, half of them to be white. So those are the predictions, and to test it, you actually just go through with the cross. You actually do the cross and look at the offspring. That'll tell you which of these is actually true. Notice, by the way, that if you get just one white-flowered individual, that is proof. On the other hand, this is another importance of sample size. If you do this and get just one offspring and it's purple, you're really not sure, right? You could have just gotten lucky. You could have gotten lucky with three purple flowers. But if you do it with a bunch and there's never any whites, then it means this must be true. If you get one white, this has to be true. So that's why it's a test cross. Now on to 9, and we have another cross here that is very similar to a monohybrid cross, but this one is not. Look at the parents here, first of all. How many characteristics are we looking at? No, it's more than one.
Two.
What are the characteristics? Seed shape is one. What's the other one? And seed color. Okay. Now, how many traits are we looking at? Four overall, right? But only two traits for each of those two characteristics. So there's two and only two possible colors, yellow and green. And there's two and only two in the whole population I'm talking about. Two and only two shapes, which are round, which are the smooth ones, or wrinkled. Also notice that the parents differ in their traits for each of the two characteristics. One of them is yellow instead of green. One of them is round instead of wrinkled. So this is called a dihybrid cross, which is simply two monohybrid crosses done at the same time. It simply means that we're paying attention to two characteristics at the same time, ignoring all the others. If you did this same exact cross and just ignored their texture or their shape, it would be a monohybrid cross. But we're paying attention to shape here too. Okay? It's a hybrid though for the same reason. The parents differ in their traits. Now look at the genotypes for these parents. Each diploid genotype is four letters long, which makes sense, right? We're broadening our attention to two different genes. Therefore, a diploid is going to have two alleles for each gene and four overall alleles. So there's four letters. Two of them are Ys, though, which stands for yellow, which happens to be the dominant color for seeds. And two of them are Rs, which stands for round, which is the dominant shape. Okay, so one of them is upper-upper Y, upper-upper R. The other one's lower-lower Y, lower-lower R. In other words, one of these parents, the one on the left, is doubly homozygous dominant, meaning that it's homozygous dominant for seed color. It's also homozygous dominant for seed shape. The other one's a doubly homozygous recessive individual. Okay, well, everything happens the same as we've already been talking about. We're just paying attention to two different characteristics. So when meiosis occurs, which it has to produce the gametes, one of the Ys is going to be chosen, one of the Rs is going to be chosen, but they're true breeders. So once again, there's only one possible gamete that each of these parents can make, because that's what true breeding really means. Uppercase Y, uppercase R for that parent, lowercase Y, lowercase R for that parent. Well, since there's only one possible gamete for each of these two, there's only one possible zygote they can make. You could actually make a Punnett square for this. One of them, but it's going to be a pretty simple one. One parent has to make an upper Y, upper R gamete. The other one has to make lower Y, lower R gamete. And so it's going to have just one box in it. Upper Y, lower Y, upper R, lower R. It's another way of saying 100% of the F1s are going to have this genotype. And they therefore will all have the same traits. Yellowness, which is dominant, and roundness, which is dominant. Genotypically, they all in the F1 are double heterozygotes. But because there's complete dominance of yellow over green and complete dominance of round over wrinkled, that means every one of these heterozygous individuals is doubly dominant in its traits. Is that all clear? We then have two different Punnett squares for the F2. Once again, to test two different possibilities. Notice that one of these Punnett squares, the smaller one, corresponds to the hypothesis of dependent assortment. Dependent assortment would mean that how one tetrad or pair of chromosomes lines up during metaphase of meiosis depends on how the others line up. In other words, they all line up the same, either all red up and blue down or the other way around. The other one, though, the bigger Punnett square, tests for the possibility of independent assortment. All tetrads independently line up and flip their own coins. Well, I've already told you that that's what the truth is, right? Actual assortment is independent. So you'd expect this bigger Punnett square to actually come true, and it does. The reason there are 16 boxes in here, though, is because each of these two heterozygous parents, they are parents of the F2. Each one of them can produce four different gametes. Because you can pick upper Y, upper Y, lower R, lower Y, upper R, lower Y, lower R. Those are the four possibilities. And therefore, each 4x4 is going to give you 16 possible zygotes when you match them up. Well, this is another famous Mendelian ratio. 9:3 to 3:1 phenotypic ratio. The reason there's four numbers here is because there's four combinations of traits when you care about two characteristics. All right? And what this means is there are nine dominant color, dominant shaped individuals to three dominant color recessive shaped to three recessive color to dominant and dominant shape to one recessive color and recessive shape. There's only one way to be green and wrinkled. You have to get your gametes from your parents that they're both lower Y, lower R. Okay? Everything else is going to be dominant for at least one of the two traits. And there's nine ways that you can get dominant for both color and shape. That's what this is talking about. So 9:3 to 3:1, that applies to dihybrid cross. It's analogous to the 3:1 phenotypic ratio in a monohybrid cross. Slide 10 uses flippings of coins to represent the randomness of choosing gametes. That's what random fertilization is, right? No gamete is favored over any other, so they all have exactly equal probabilities of being chosen, so to speak. Just like when you flip a truly fair coin, exactly one half of the time you're expected to get a head, the other time a tail. So mathematically, when you have to do two of these random activities, choose a sperm and choose an egg, each one is its own coin. Well, if you're going to get two heads, which it would be for this box, this kind of zygote, the probability of doing that is the mathematical product or multiplication of the two individual probabilities. So to get the first head is one half times the second head, which is one half, and overall that's one quarter. Each of these boxes has one quarter, and notice that in a Punnett square, probabilistically, all of the zygote probabilities have to add up to one, because something has to happen. They add up to one, which is 100%, the whole. Okay, so that ends the Mendelian part of the chapter. Everything we've been talking about obeyed those two requirements. Exactly two alleles for each gene that you study in the population. And one of those two alleles completely dominates over the other. It will work if that's true, but it's not always true in reality, right? There aren't always exactly two traits for a given characteristic, like the one I use as an example. Eye color has many traits, right? So anything that violates those requirements happens the same way as far as the molecules are concerned. It's not that it's happening differently. It's just that these ratios don't turn out to be the same. And this is why if Mendel had just chosen things that do not follow Mendelian rules, it would, even with his high number of sample sizes, it would have been confusing as hell to him. It would have been harder for him to figure things out. So there's multiple different categories of exceptions to Mendelian genetics. They collectively make up non-Mendelian genetics, but we're going to look at them one exception at a time, starting with slide 11. And the name for this particular exception is incomplete dominance, which, of course, just by its name should tell you it's an exception, right? When one of the requirements of Mendelian genetics is that you have complete dominance, something that's incomplete dominance must be an exception. How many characteristics are we looking at here? One, it's flower color again, even though these aren't pea plants. It's flower color is the one characteristic we're looking at. But notice there are two traits. Even though there are only two alleles. So it seems just like the purple-white pea plant flower color one. There's only two alleles, and we're looking at just one characteristic. But it works out differently because the dominance is not complete. This uses a different standard. Really, there should only be one standard for it to be a true standard, but genetics, genotypes are written different ways depending on what's going on. And so here we have C for the color gene fitted with a superscript, either an R for red or a W for white. Red is dominant over white in this case, but not completely. And so the only way for an individual to be red-flowered is to be homozygous dominant. The only way to be white is to be homozygous recessive. Heterozygous individuals, on the other hand, are pink instead of red or white. And this should make sense to you based on what you've learned about how genes work. The genes themselves do not give the organism its traits, right? Instead, the proteins that the genes indirectly code for give the individual its trait. A heterozygous individual has one red allele. A homozygous dominant individual has two. Two identical pieces of DNA on the two different chromosomes. The white version of the allele here is really not producing anything. And so that makes the flower look white to us. The red allele produces a protein that makes the flower look red to us. Okay? But in a homozygous dominant individual, there are two versions of that red DNA that can work at the same time, being transcribed at the same time. That's going to produce twice as much identical mRNA, which can then simultaneously be translated into twice as much protein product, which gives the redness. So it makes sense, actually, that being a heterozygous individual, you're not going to be as red as you are if you have double the DNA for redness. And that's exactly what's happening. Pink is not really a new material. It's just what it looks like when you have only half the redness. Fully red is a double dose of red protein product. It just depends on the gene and the organism, though. In the case of the flower color for peas, having just one purple allele was enough. Didn't make it any more purple to be homozygous dominant. But here it does matter. And so that's called incomplete dominance. Three traits, two alleles, one dominant over the other, but only incompletely. This one is a slide that's actually two slides in one, in a sense, because there are two independent, they don't have anything to do with each other, two different ways in which this is an exception to Mendelian genetics. It uses human blood groups, or one human blood group. There are really dozens of human blood groups, but there's really only two that matter to most people. And those are the ABO blood group and the RH group. The reason those are the ones that everyone knows is because those are the ones that can kill you if you're not careful in transfusing. But there's all kinds of other ones, and they all have nothing to do with each other. Well, ABO doesn't have anything to do with RH either. We're not looking at RH here, but when we give a person's blood type, that's really one overall designation of the results for two different groups. Like A negative, that means A in the ABO group, plus negative in the RH group. Nothing to do with each other. Here we're looking at just the ABO group. And the first reason that I'll mention for why this is an exception is that, well, the category's name is multiple alleles. But multiple here doesn't mean two or more. Multiple means three or more. That's why it's an exception. Remember that the requirement for Mendelian is exactly two. Here you have three or more. Or if you have three or more, that's an exception. And we call that multiple alleles. But in this particular case, it's three. Still more than two, though. So it's not going to be the same. The alleles' genotypes are written with I's. That I stands for immunoglobulin, which is the kind of protein that makes up an antibody. But that's each I has a superscript or not. I super A is the A type allele. I super B is the B type allele. And lowercase I with no superscript is the O type allele. O really is zero. That's what it originally denoted, I think. But it means that there is no product for that gene. Nothing is produced, like in the white-flowered ones. But there are three alleles in the population. I'm talking about in the population, not in an individual. Any individual, which is a diploid human, has two alleles. But these are the three possibilities from the population. All right, now, the immunoglobulins are actual antibodies, which are proteins in the plasma. The plasma is the liquid component of the blood, outside of the blood cells, but still part of the blood, the watery component. That's where you find antibodies. Antibodies are proteins that have a specific shape that can match up to a specific shape of something we call an antigen, which the antigens are what the antibodies are protecting us from, because the antigens are foreign material and potentially harmful. Okay, so you have antigens and antibodies. Antibodies, though, are part of plasma. Antigens, in this case, are part of the red blood cells. And that's what the alleles are coding for, really. So the antigens are represented by these basic shapes, triangles or circles, on the red blood cell surface. They're carbohydrates, but they have a specific shape. And a person that has at least one A allele, it's either IA or IAI, which is IAO, that person will produce on its blood cells A-type antigens. Now, those are supposed to be there. That's that person's own blood. But in that same person's plasma, where the antibodies are, that means there can't be any antibodies that recognize A antigens. Otherwise, that person's blood would attack itself. So in an A person, the antibodies in the plasma would be called anti-B antibodies, because they would recognize B's but not A's, and B is foreign. Exact opposite for type B, you can be IBIB or IBI to be B. That person will have B antigens on the cells, but the plasma will have anti-A antibodies. Okay, then there's the type AB person. This is a heterozygous individual, IA, IB. And that, therefore, since there's one of each of these alleles, both types of antigens are produced. And therefore, the plasma better not have either kind of antibody, because either kind of antibody would kill this kind of cell. And then finally, there's type O person, which is you have to have two of these recessive O type alleles. That gives you no antigens on the red blood cells. And correspondingly, the plasma of a type O person is going to have both kinds of antibodies. This is why when you transfuse, you don't transfuse whole blood, both cells and plasma, unless you're going to exactly the same type of person. Okay? So when you hear the terms universal donor and universal recipient, that means of red blood cells only. You want to spin it down, get rid of the plasma. You can give O cells to anyone because they're not going to be attacked by any kind of antibodies. But you would never want to give O plasma to anyone other than a type O, because O plasma is going to kill all kinds, all these other three kinds. Okay, anyway, that's multiple alleles. That's an exception for one reason. The other exception, which I have just enough time to finish talking about, is called codominance. So don't confuse this with incomplete dominance. Co means share. In codominance, you have two alleles that neither one dominates over the other, and each allele gets, or the trait for each of the traits, one corresponding to each of the two alleles, each trait gets fully expressed at the same time. All right? So this is what an AB person demonstrates. A is not dominant over B. It is dominant over O. But A is not dominant over B. B is not dominant over A. If you have one of each, therefore, you are type AB, which means you are just as much a type A person as a fully type A person, but at the same time, you're just as much a type B person as a fully type B person. Both traits are expressed fully. And you don't have that in other cases, in normal Mendelian cases. It has to be when you have codominance. That is where I'll stop. So remind me that I'm on 13.